Call the meeting to order. So as he turns on the flip switch. Call the meeting of the Agriculture, Rural Economies, Veterans Affairs Committee to order. And we'll start right away with the University of Minnesota. Oh, Colby first. I'm not paying attention. I was in Rules Committee having a nice discussion on time parameters, so that's why I'm late.
I missed that.
Yeah, you missed it. I got it. We missed you up there, too.
Should have brought cookies.
Do we have a quorum? All right. All right, here's what we're doing today. Members, and we have, if you remember last year, we did the extension of the Farmer Lender Mediation Bill. At that time, some discussion arose on, de minimis levels for filing for mediation and other questions on the statute in general. I had an agreement with the parties involved that we'd have a hearing on this after we hopefully could gather some more information. The University of Minnesota at that time indicated they didn't have a lot of good information on dollar amounts that were being mediated or filed for or other things. So basically what we're going to do today is start with our House research staff, who will walk us through the farmer lender mediation statutes. I don't know if we have those in our folder, staff, do we? Okay, I don't know if we have anything to look at, but I apologize for that. But we'll go through the statutes, what they do, their history, and then we'll have the University of Minnesota come up and give us some updates on where they're at, how the mediation program's going, is it being used more or less, and what they're finding for dollar amounts, etc., and hopefully answer some questions. Okay, we've got a, well, there it is. All right, he's got it popped up now. All right, welcome, Mr. Sullivan. Introduce yourself for the committee and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Colby Sullivan. I'm the nonpartisan analyst for the House Research Department, who staffed this committee and the comparable policy committee. I was asked to give a kind of a brief recap of the Farmer Lender Mediation Act today. I'm going to talk about quickly what the act is, when and why it was enacted, and the changes that this body approved and the legislature enacted last session. So what is the Farmer Lender Mediation Act? In general, it's a state law that requires a creditor to offer mediation to a farmer before enforcing a debt against agricultural property. The debt has to exceed $5,000 to be eligible for mediation, and it applies to the following actions that a lender or creditor would take: foreclosure, repossession, cancellation of a contract or deed, or executing a court order or judgment against agricultural property. So, for example, a farmer has a mortgage on the farm and falls behind on the payments, and according to the terms of the mortgage, the lender determines that the farmer is in default, and whereas normally the lender may proceed with a foreclosure process, state law would require the lender to first offer the farmer a chance to mediate the situation. State law requires the lender to send a letter to the farmer. The farmer has the option of entering mediation or not, but the option has to be presented. And by law, the University of Minnesota is in charge of coordinating the mediation process and carrying out the law. So there are some eligibility restrictions. The farm in this case has to be a family farm or organized as a family farm corporation or an authorized farm corporation. These are terms that are defined in a different statute that in general prohibits corporations and some other business types from owning farmland or farming in Minnesota. There are more exemptions in that law that allow farming for some different business types, but the Farmer Lender Mediation Act appears to me to be a little more restrictive in that it's available just to these three types. There's also a size limitation. If the farm or the farmer owns or manages or leases, fewer than 60 acres, then in the preceding year they have to have earned at least $20,000 in the sale of ag products to qualify for the mediation. So what are we talking about with agricultural property under the law? In my opinion, most of the property that one would think of with a farming operation, the land, if it's primarily used for farming as well as personal property, that's put up as collateral for the credit or used in the farm operation. So that statute specifically cites equipment, crops, and livestock as eligible personal property. However, the mediation statute does not apply to leased property unless the farmer is leasing that equipment and it's a removable structure and the farmer has an option to purchase it. So if the farmer is leasing a grain bin and according to the terms of the contract has an option to purchase that grain bin, then that would be eligible for mediation under the law. It also doesn't apply to mechanics or storage liens on personal property. So if the farmer's tractor is at the mechanic's shop and farmer, for whatever reason, can't pay for the repairs and the mechanic holds on to the tractor in lieu of payment, that's not eligible for mediation. And finally, neither is machinery that's used primarily for custom field work. So a sprayer that would be used primarily to apply to other farmers' property for hire, that would not be eligible. So when was the Farmer Lender Mediation Act enacted? This is an excerpt right out of statute. It kind of breaks the cardinal rule of putting way too many words on a PowerPoint slide, but this is I think kind of captures the sentiment of the legislature at the time during the farm credit crisis of the 80s. I won't read the whole thing, but the last sentence is sort of the lead-in, or the last sentence in the preamble, and it states that the agricultural economic emergency requires an orderly process with state assistance to adjust agricultural indebtedness, to prevent civil unrest, and to preserve the general welfare and fiscal integrity of the state. So that's sort of the context, and the legislature responded in 1986 to the farm crisis with the act. I put this here, it's really hard to read, but it just kind of shows the large number of provisions that were included in this act related to the ag crisis. Farmer lender mediation is just one of those provisions. The act, it was laws of Minnesota 1986, chapter 368, also included creation of the Rural Finance Administration, now called the Rural Finance Authority, the right of first refusal, creation of a family farm legal assistance program under the jurisdiction of the Supreme Court, capital gain exclusion if the farmer had to involuntarily give up the farm, reactivation of an ag data task force. There were also modifications to vehicle size and weight limitations to accommodate farm vehicles. And there was an appropriation of approximately $16 million for various programs. That's roughly $31 million in today's dollars. And that's just a partial listing of the provisions in that act.
Mr. Sullivan, do you know if all those are still in effect today or if some of those since been sunsetted?
Some have since been sunsetted, Mr. Chair and members. I have some chicken scratches here. I went through and tried to kind of see which ones were still around. Several are, maybe pieces of them have been eliminated, but several of those provisions remain while some have expired.
I guess in particular, how about the right of first refusal?
That's still in law. I think it may have changed, but that right is still in law. So then we'll jump forward to last year and the changes that this body approved and that were eventually enacted into law. Laws of Minnesota 2009, Chapter 94 was the Ag and Vets Omnibus Budget Act. That extended the sunset for farmer lender mediation from June 30th, 2009 to June 30th, 2013. That was the 13th such extension. Roughly every 2 to 4 years, the legislature has revisited the act and extended the sunset date. House File 841, top point, was the original bill, and that proposed eliminating the sunset outright. That was amended in the Ag and Vets Policy Committee to instead extend the sunset date, and that bill was referred to this committee and rolled into the omnibus bill. And another change that happened last year is now the creditors, when they send the mandatory mediation offer to the farmer, they have to include the amount of the debt in the notice. And they also have to send a copy of that notice to the Extension Service. So here you can see the statute lays out the exact language of the mediation notice, and the part that's circled was the addition last year, that now, right in there, that the amount of the debt has to be included, the debt that's available for mediation. That's all that I have. I can try to answer any questions you might have.
Questions? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Today, a lot of co-ops or even seed companies offer input loans. Are those types of loans covered by this mediation act?
Mr. Solomon.
I would defer to the Extension Service, but I believe so. I believe if the debt is secured by farm products, eligible farm products, the farm, the tractor, something like that, then that would come under this statute. Or if the debt wasn't secured and the co-op got a court order to maybe seize the tractor as payment, then I think, again, because the target of the action would be a farm product or farm implement, then it would fall under the statute. But I could be wrong.
Could you just briefly touch on, because I think it is important, every 2 years or 3 years or 4 years or whenever the extensions happen, it always comes up the constitutionality of extending. And I think the case was made that back in the 80s there was a farm crisis, and that case has been made somewhat since then. But is there some, the argument always comes up of interference with contracts, or, you know, can you just comment briefly on that argument and how it's been overcome? Or no one's probably challenged it, I assume, since the 80s.
I did sort of scan the court cases on this statute, and if there was a case on the constitutionality of the act, I didn't find it, which doesn't mean it's not out there. I did see there was I think it was the creation of the Rural Finance Authority, there was a provision in the original law that said if this agency is found unconstitutional, then the money that was supposed to be appropriated to it would go to an interest buy-down program instead. I didn't see a similar provision in the original act for farmer lender mediation, but it could be in there. So I'm afraid I can't speak to that point.
All right. Any other questions for Mr. Sullivan? Otherwise, thank you. That was a good introduction, and now we'll bring up the University of Minnesota and a couple people from the program. And again, members, we have them in now to give us an update on the program itself. They can really talk more specific to how it's run, the type of people that are utilizing it, numbers of cases we're seeing, increase, decrease, where we're at, and then how our change in the law went and how that's now providing or not providing us information yet that we need to look at some of the issues we talked about last year. So welcome to the committee. You can introduce yourselves as you see fit and proceed.
Great, thank you. For the record, my name is Dick Sinise. I'm Associate Dean with the University of Minnesota Extension and have responsibilities for the Farmer Lender Mediation Program. Chair Junkie and representatives, today I'm here to update you on the Farmer Lender Mediation Program. Farmer Lender is part of USDA's Certified State Agricultural Mediation Program that provides farmers and their creditors the opportunity to renegotiate, restructure, or resolve farm debt. And I'm going to put a map up here on the screen. You can see the states that are part of...
You can zoom that in so that the people can see the map better. There's a zoom button on that. There you go.
Wow. We have to get one of these at the university.
Yeah.
Anyway, as you might expect, given our current financial conditions, more farmers and their lenders are using the program this year over previous years. The past year saw an increase in every measure of activity in the program, number of mediation notices filed by lenders, number of farmers in mediation, and the total amount of debt involved in mediation. Specifically, last year, the legislature and this committee asked us to provide more data on the program. Specifically, you asked for information on the initial loan that triggered the mediation. A bill allowing us to collect that information came out of this committee and resolved our problem of not having the information. The revised law went into effect in July of 2009. We are still doing some education with lenders about the change, and you'll see that reflected in the data I show you today. The information I'm sharing today is based on the data we collected from July 1st, 2009 through January 21st, 2010. Given the nature of farming and farm loans, a full year worth of data may provide more insights and may be more reliable. As you heard, a creditor with a secured debt of more than $5,000 must offer farmer lender mediation before proceeding with a number of other options. The farmer has the choice of either participating in the mediation process or waiving mediation by not responding within 14 days to the mediation notice. So I'm going to put a chart up here, and I'm going to try to control some of the zooming here. I'll walk you through this chart, which I believe you all have in front of you, which is based on the amount of the loan that initiated a mediation notice being filed with our office. You can see those amounts in these rows. So these rows here indicate sort of the amount of the initiating debt, kind of ranges. The numbers in the first column on the left under the title Mandatory Mediation are for those farm operations that opted for mediation. So they received the notice, and within 14 days they said, yes, we would like to mediate our loans. As you can see, about a third of the initiating debt was under $50,000 for the 172 farm operations who opted for mediation. Across those 172 operations, you'll see a line under there that says total loans. Total loans were 539 individual debt obligations with a total debt mediated of over $106 million. Our experience is that operations with an initiating debt of under $25,000 are more likely to be less complex and require less staff time. The larger debt amounts usually involve more complex mediations and involve more staff time. The middle column is on voluntary mediations. Try to see if we can zoom that in for people here. There we go. On voluntary mediations. These are cases where the farmer or the creditor has applied to our program to have mediation resolve a troubled loan. We had two farm operations take part in voluntary mediation during the period, and in both cases the loan was more than $50,000. The third column is those farmers who waived participation in mediation within 14 days of receiving the creditor's notice. So we don't know a lot about these individuals and their debt situation since they did not participate in mediation. That leads to some inconsistencies in the chart. The letter sent by lenders, as Mr. Sullivan showed us, is prescribed by statute and reads, the amount of outstanding debt is. Some lenders are interpreting that to mean the amount of back payments currently owed. And since the change in the law in July, we have seen a number of lenders write down the amount the farmer is behind in payments and not the total amount of the loan. And so you'll see that for that shows up here under mandatory under the waiver column. You'll see that there are 85 operations that we have listed where the initial debt reported to us was under $5,000. With the mandatory mediation column, this problem is corrected and reflects the total amount of debt, not the amount in arrears. This is possible because of information collected during the course of mediation. In 100% of the cases where the creditor initially recorded an amount less than $5,000 on the first letter, we learned that this represents the amount currently owed, and the amount of the loan was greater than $5,000 in the mediation cases. So cases that proceed to mediation, the amount of the actual loan has always been greater than $5,000, even though the amount on the letter may have been less initially. So we're continuing the education process with lenders, but quite frankly, our main focus during the last 6 months has been dealing with the increased caseload. The Farmer Lender Mediation Program receives a USDA grant that funds approximately 80% of all costs of the program. The remainder is funded by University of Minnesota Extension. Marianne Pricer, who is joining me today, is the Program Director for Farmer Lender Mediation. She began in 1986 in the first cohort of mediators the university trained, and in 1999 became our program director. She'll speak briefly with a few details about the program. Marianne?
Thank you. Chairman Junkie and representatives. Dick asked me to share a few factors that have changed in mediation during the last few years. Three of those are the financial trouble for livestock producers is driving an increase in the number of farms entering mediation. Last fiscal year, 62% of the cases entering mediation were livestock producers. That trend appears to be continuing this year. The loss of off-farm jobs leads to financial problems for many of our farmers. We see mediation in farmers where the spouse or both the debtor and the spouse have been recently laid off. The farm depended on that off-farm income to cash flow and ran into trouble paying the farm bills when that income went away. We're also seeing more beginning farmers and more farmers who are new to Minnesota using Minnesota mediation. These farms tend to be smaller and may grow specialty crops. The debt levels that trigger mediation for these smaller farms and specialty crop farmers tends to be under $25,000. Thank you, Chair Junkie and committee members, and Dick and I look forward to answering any questions you may have.
All right, so again, members, we'll certainly take questions. I guess I want to get a feeling from you. It sounds like you're working with them to, the language was ambiguous, a wee bit ambiguous that we put in. I don't think it was, but they're interpreting it that way. And you're doing some education. These numbers reflect, what, 6 months of information?
Right, just over 6 months.
So you're hopeful that over the next 6 months before we come back that you'll have maybe a better handle on some of the waivered amounts and can address that a little more thoroughly, I assume. I do think it's interesting, and I hadn't thought about it, that off-farm employment is the cause of a lot of mediation right now. I don't think I had put that together till today, that a spouse losing their job or losing their insurance or whatever it is that's causing it. It's not necessarily the farming operation, but it's the income, total income on that homestead, which may be relied on from somewhere else. So I guess at this point I'd like you to comment, Ms. Pressler or Mr. Sinise, on do you have any recommendations at this point on de minimis levels or anything else, or what would you tell this committee?
At this, Chairman Junkie and representatives, at this point, I don't see where there needs to be any change. There does need to be some education so that we have lenders filling in that debt letter properly. We have, as you referred to, we have two different things coming in. We have the past due a payment, and sometimes we have the entire debt. That has to be clarified, but I think we can do that through education.
We have elevator folks sitting in the room and others. One of the anecdotal things that was brought up last year was that this program perhaps is being used as a collection program, particularly over in the waivered side of things, where someone gets behind a month or two in their feed bill and the elevator or feed mill then sends a mediation notice. The farmer gets it, says, oh my, and pays the bill. And then 2 months later, they're behind again and they send them another notice. They pay the bill. And that's why we're seeing the waiver. That was anecdotal last year. What can you tell us about the waivers on the right-hand column and who's using that and why are they being waived? Obviously, there's a lot more of those than anything else.
Let me speak to that first, then ask Mary Nell to comment. In the waiver column, our history shows that the plurality of those come from implement dealers, and then the second category would be banks. So we wouldn't be seeing the feed examples in there very much. But Mary Nell has more case experience with these, of course.
Generally, if it's coming from a feed dealer or so forth, they have secured a judgment and are enforcing collection of the judgment. It would not be an open account. So we're not seeing that very often.
Okay. So you're not seeing it used as a collection tool?
I don't think it is.
My other question, then, I guess I'd like you to expand a little bit more. Again, the other... When you see the dollar amounts of $5,000 or $10,000, and again, I'll make the sarcastic comment that I think I made to you in my office, but because some people probably are thinking it, and I certainly thought it too. You know, when you see someone filing for mediation for $5,000 or $7,000 or $8,000, I mean, most of us think, oh my goodness, in my head. I get credit card offers in the mail every week that would give me at least that amount if I was that close to being in debt and not being able to pay my bills. Why would I want to go through mediation and why wouldn't I pay it? And why? So can you talk a little bit about who those people may be and why the small amounts that show up once in a while on mediation, and is that an important thing for them to go through or not? And just talk about that a little bit, because again, a lot of us think, well, geez, under 25,000, who couldn't find some relatives or a small loan from a credit card company or somewhere to pay that debt?
Chair Junkie and representatives, yes, we've heard the same thing as what you have just reiterated there. The under the $5,000 level gives us an opportunity to come in earlier. If we come in later after we have a huge debt that's in arrears, we can't be as effective. And many of these only take one or two meetings. Many of these can even be done on the telephone to save expenses, because they are probably not as complex. But it at least lets us come in earlier so that we can provide that service before it becomes such a massive problem. And we have many creditors who are not being paid. At this point, we can get in at an earlier time. Also, we find that many times we're coming in on the smaller operations that are around in that area, and many of those are beginning farmers, or they're farmers who are new to Minnesota. We have many Minnesotans who are specialty crops, and they have brought this knowledge from other lands, and now they're in Minnesota. And so we serve about 18% that probably fall underneath the 25,000 area. But in that 18%, we get in earlier, and we provide a service to an underserved population.
Just to that last point, we're certainly aware that the Hmong in particular bring a lot of farming skills with them. If a Hmong grower, say at St. Paul Farmers Market, is leasing a plot of land, do they qualify for farmer lender mediation if they don't own the land? And if they live down, you know, in a neighborhood in St. Paul, drive out, and are they considered a farmer? Do they qualify for mediation on that operation?
Chair Junkie and representatives, we had the Office of General Counsel look into that at the university to see what the $5,000 limit and the 60 acres and the $20,000 worth of income. And that's where they would come in, is under that $20,000 worth of income. And we have had individuals like that we have serviced.
Okay. Any questions, members? Representative Magnus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and to our testifiers. Also, in the amounts we're talking about, is the creditor adding the finance charges onto that also? Is that the amount that you would see go forth, or how does that work? Because, and I know interest rates are low, Mr. Chairman, but at least a lot of my creditors are quick to slip in this percent and a half a month if you... or 18% a year if you don't pay your bill on time, and using that to do a little fundraising, I think. But, you know, when you get a $50,000 level and you start throwing money around like that, in a few months you got some significant charges on that. So are those being included in this?
Chair Junkie and representatives, yes, they're being included.
Okay.
Yes, I would say a majority of time, when it goes through mediation,
yeah,
everything is included. It's supposed to be the whole pie is put on the table, and we sort everything out and come up with a feasible plan. So, yes, all of that would be included.
Any further questions? Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. You mentioned that the 62% of your mediation starting things are livestock producers. Do you have any numbers as to if that group of producers, are those loans higher, or do they tend to be all over the board as well with your livestock producers?
Mr. Chair, representatives, I don't think we've analyzed the data to be able to answer that question for you, but Mary Nell might be able to speak from her experience in running the program.
Ms. Price, sir.
We have a gamut that runs all the way from, especially in the dairy industry and in the pork industry, that runs from the small farmer all the way to the top. And so there is no average, and we service all the program services, those that have got 20 sows and those that have got 50,000.
Tell me again how What was the increase in mediations this year compared to last year, percent-wise?
Sure. Mr. Chair, representatives, between federal fiscal year 08 and 09, mediations went up 55%.
55% increase.
For this six-month period, I looked this morning, this six-month period as compared to a year prior, it's up 59%.
Okay. And how many people does it take to run this program, and what is the federal grant amount you get to run
the
program?
Sure. Mr. Chair, representatives, we run on an FTE, full-time equivalence, of just over five. We have a cohort of mediators that actually do the work, and so most of them work hourly. The federal grant pays for about 80% of the program, and in the last federal fiscal year, that was about $330,000, with the university share about $85,000.
And how in a year like this do you handle that increased workload? Is it just something that's picked up by the university? If you blow through that $330,000 and now you have to go out and hire more hourly people, I assume, to help and perform the mediations?
Mr. Chair, representatives, we monitor the expenses very closely, as you might imagine, and have asked Mary Nell and her staff to do a number of things that cut expenses. Our biggest expenses are always going to be things like travel and those kinds of things. And now we're doing a lot more of the sort of less complex cases over the phone. And we're also cutting some staff development opportunities that we create for mediators and some of those things. But we monitor pretty closely and run up to the wire, usually.
Okay. Any further discussion from the university? All right. And certainly anyone else that wants to come up and testify, whether you have a blue shirt on or not today. And by the way, we welcome the class. Who are they? Representative Tremba, do you know? Representative Eakin,
tell us who's in the room here. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I'd like to recognize the emerging leaders of the Red River Valley here today. Leading members of the communities in these areas. So welcome to our committee.
Okay.
Another University of Minnesota Extension Program, right. And the emerging leaders, we are aware of you, and we do see the blue shirts once in a while, so we're glad you're here watching, and anyone that feels they want to participate, all you have to do is go tell the pages on either side that you'd like to testify, and they'll bring your name up here. If you've got something you just think you should add to the conversation, we welcome it. And speaking of welcoming, the banks are in the room, too, and we do want to hear from them. So welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you very much. David Skilbright, Vice President of the Independent Community Bankers of Minnesota. Just a couple of quick comments. Number one, I talked with Ms. Preisler this morning before the committee meeting about this new chart and this new information. And last summer when this new law became effective with regards to the change in the form and the requirement that the lenders add the amount of debt on the form, we did some collaborative educational things with our members to try to get the word out about what to do. We will continue to do that in light of the fact that some people are reporting the amount that is past due as opposed to the total amount in debt, which is really what we wanted. And when you look in that chart, the Extension Service put that number of 85 with the little footnote of number 2 there. That's the issue that we're trying to get at there. Number 2, with respect to the mandatory mediation numbers, which are more accurate because they have the portfolio and the folder to look at, it was reported that about one-third of those mediations are with debts below $50,000. In the future, one thing that I'll be interested to see is more detail about those 116 mediations for debt greater than $50,000, because the total amount there reported that is being mediated is $106 million. If you look at that 33% below $50,000, dollar-wise, that's going to be a very small amount. So the real activity and the interest is going to be in that amount above $50,000. And then finally, just to throw one number out there again, mediation notices filed did go up 55% from 2008 to 2009. rising from 2,002 notices to 3,107, but the number of cases that completed mediation rose only 12% from 377 up to 422.
Okay.
Thank you.
Just a comment, maybe you can comment on it too, I'm going to put you on the spot, but what I'm hearing from the Extension Service and others, you know, we're looking at this and whether we have to take action or not. I think it's their sense that working with your group, or if we have to change language and statute to make it more clear, we can do that this year too. But it would be helpful to get to the end at least of the federal year that they get their monies for, which would be through September, and we'd have a full year worth of data. And maybe we can start straightening out the waivered amount over there too. Are you comfortable with us, waiting another to get a full year's worth of data before we readdress this, which technically will probably be then next year in our omnibus bill if there's something to do?
Mr. Chairman and members, yes, I'm comfortable in doing that. I think the one thing that we should consider, though, is whether or not we need to clarify the language. I agree with you. It seemed to me that it was pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
Sometimes we learn that what we think is straightforward isn't around here. So if we need to tighten that up, we can maybe do that this year, but anything more than that, personally, we think is not necessary.
Okay, and we'll talk about that with the university and with you and others in the room that are involved with that, because that's really the key, you know, that they're not just sending the amount, that's in the rears for payments, but they're sending that total debt that could be mediated if they defaulted. So
right.
That's what we're after. Any questions? All right, thank you. Anyone else in the audience want to weigh in on this issue? Now's your chance. Otherwise, I think, members, we've had a good discussion, and certainly as we proceed over the next couple months to hopefully putting a bill out of here, if there's some clarity we can make on the reporting and the letter writing that's going on, we should do that. If members think that there's a reason to raise that de minimis right now, we can certainly talk about that further. My sense is we should probably wait, and I think everyone's in agreement, to get more data over the next 6 or 8 months. A lot of those mediations may still be coming too, we get into, and I didn't ask them, but I did ask them in my office. One of the problems they're suspecting they're going to see is when producers go into the bank for operating loans this spring, a lot of them may be surprised that they're not qualifying for them in the way that they used to, and we may see an uptick in some of that activity. And I think it'd be good to see that come through, too, with information before we make any decisions on it. So with that, we'll move on to our agenda. Thank you to the university and all those that were here for that. First of all, Representative Anderson Paul moves the minutes of February 16th. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
I oppose. Minutes are adopted. And you just heard that back in the 80s we put in farmer lender mediation, and we also put in the RFA at that time when we had a farm crisis and we were looking for tools and ways to assist farmers. The Department of Agriculture in Minnesota, along with the legislature, initiated the RFA program. I thought it'd be helpful, a lot of us are fairly new to this committee or new to the legislature, if we just had a brief overview of what the RFA is again, how it's functioned over the last 20 plus years, and what kind of programs and monies are available for beginning farmers or other growers and producers out there through your agency. So welcome to the committee, former representative, and introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Jim Borbom, Deputy Commissioner with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. And as the chairman mentioned, I did serve in the legislature one term in the 1986-87, and I was a part of the conversation and part of the conference committee that established the Rural Finance Authority as well as the mediation program. So it's good to see again, especially with the Rural Finance Authority. I've had the privilege in the last few years of it providing some administrative oversight to that program. I think it's a great example of a public-private partnership that works very, very well. We have a very good participation from about 400 commercial banks and 32 farm credit offices, so we've got a great history. I'm here today just to go through a few slides that talks about the history of the Rural Finance Authority, some highlights on the loan programs that we administer through the RFA, and then the financial condition of the program. I'm going to ask Peter Shepherd, who is the current executive director of the Rural Finance Authority, to join me, and he can answer all the tough questions. I'll just provide some background perspective as to how we got to the program that we have today. So I think, are we...
What is our computer help in here? Need to get there. Hooked up. There we go.
Looks familiar.
I knew there was someone young enough in this room that understood technology that could take care of that.
Thanks for your patience. Again, the Rural Finance Authority was established by the 1986 Minnesota Legislature, and I'm just going to have Peter cue through the slides. The legislature found, as you heard, with the mandatory mediation, there was also a lot of, I think, adversity and some very stressful times, and the legislature recognized the stress. They recognized the economic impact of a collapsed farm economy, what that would mean to rural areas. And so they essentially talked about the language you can see recognizes that legislative perspective. The economic conditions that necessitated the establishment of the programs to provide new sources of credit on favorable terms and conditions. And so that was one of the legislative findings. And also as part of that, the 1986 legislature authorized the sale of $50 million in general obligation bonds for the purpose of the program. And a little bit later in this presentation, I'll talk more about what that bond authorization means. Well, the purpose of the Rural Finance Authority is essentially to provide eligible Minnesota farmers affordable financing under terms and conditions not available from other credit resources. The first program offered by the Rural Finance Authority was really a restructure program. It was a way to find ways to restructure debt. Land values had collapsed. We were looking at double-digit interest rates. There were negative earnings. It was just a real tough economic conditions. And so finding ways to restructure loan was one of the first steps of this program. The way the program works is it first begins with a legislative authorization, that $50 million authorization that was established by the 86th legislature. There are many other authorizations throughout the course of the history of the program. But the bonding authority is granted by the legislature. Then there's essentially an RFA board, which is an 11-member board. There are six public members of that board appointed by the governor. And then there are five agency heads. The first one is the Department of Agriculture, Employment and Economic Development, Department of Finance, and Department of Commerce. And also the state auditor is a member of the Rural Finance Authority board. The board's action then is to pass a resolution requesting the Department of Minnesota Management and Budget to sell bonds. And the size or the sale of that bond sale is really determined by the level of loan activity or loan demand that we might anticipate in the next 6 months or the next 9 month period. Once the bonds are sold, and we've had very good history with the sale of the bonds, we've got a number of different authorities that will bid on these bonds. The cash generated from that sale then is used to purchase a qualifying loan, and I'll talk more about the mechanics of the loan. So essentially, bonds are sold, the cash is available, a lender will originate a real estate loan, and the Rural Finance Authority buys a portion of that qualifying loan with the cash proceeds from the sale of the bond. It's interesting then, the principal interest receipts on the loans then are deposited into what's called a dedicated account. So the nice thing about this program is the fact that it is user finance. And so as we collect the principal and interest receipts, the money goes to a dedicated account. Minnesota Management and Budget then will sweep the money out of that dedicated account every year to repay the debt service on the bond. So that's how the program works. As I mentioned in my opening remarks, there's about 450 lending institutions that partner with the Rural Finance Authority. There's also a requirement that members using the program participate in the farm management program, and so there's about 90 individuals that provide farm management services across the state. The major programs, we have five major programs offered by the Rural Finance Authority. Two of them are called the Basic and Seller Assisted Program, targeted toward entry-level farmers. As far as the net worth, we're looking at a net worth of about $409,000 that's indexed every year for inflation, and the loan participation that the Rural Finance Authority carries is 45% of the qualifying loan up to $300,000. So in the final analysis on all these loan programs, the bank or a lender, ag lender will originate the loan and then make an application to our office to buy 45%, and they retain the other 55%. One of the programs that has had a lot of activity in recent years is the Ag Improvement Loan Program. Again, the same level of net worth requirement and the same level of participation at $300,000. And Peter can talk more about this, but we're seeing an increased level of activity and interest in the Restructure Program, again, because of some hard financial conditions in the livestock sector, especially in dairy and hogs. And this is a program that's designed to help farmers reorganize their debt. If they're looking at the top half of the balance sheets upside down and they got more outstanding debt than they got current assets, it's a way they can refinance that on long-term debt. The net worth is much higher at $772,000, and the loan, again, is limited to 45%.
When you say it's indexed for inflation, does that change it every year then, based on inflation? That's why it's a 772. It's an odd number.
Correct.
That wasn't set in statute. That just goes up automatically with inflation.
Correct. Mr. Chairman, the way the I think the statutory set was maybe about 4 or 5 years ago, and then the statutory language does allow for an adjustment every year for inflation. As a matter of fact, this year there was a slight, it's based on the consumer price index, there was a slight decline this year, so we just decided to leave the net worth as is.
Okay, which that's a board decision annually, you
correct.
Review that?
And, right, okay. That's correct. Then again, the last program, the fifth one, is a livestock expansion program. We've seen some activity earlier, you know, when we had some profitability in the pork sector and in the dairy sector about 2 years ago, and some favorable interest rates, we saw some activity in this program, again, to help farmers expand or update livestock facilities. Net worth requirement is the same, and so is the loan limitation at $400,000. What you can see in this chart is a very wide range of loan activity, and there are two primary reasons for the change in loan activity. We found that it's very sensitive to interest rates. As interest rates, if you look on that, I believe it's in 2006, I believe it is, where we have that $13 million, that increase was largely driven by interest rates. The interest rate portion carried by the Rural Finance Authority was very stable and fixed. Commercial interest rates are going up, so the RFA was a good value. And when you had the opposite condition going back there to 2004, and now as you get further out here, this last year you saw again some significant decline. Again, interest rates part of it, but also the profitability in the livestock sector really diminished that, and high land values also had influence on that. This just shows the bond authorizations the Minnesota legislature has given over the years. And the reason that you can see it's about every 2 or 3 years there that the Department of Finance, or now known as Minnesota Management and Budget, prefers that we come to the legislature every 2 years during used to come during the bonding cycle. We'd now like to come during the budget cycle and just give an update on the program and try to forecast an appropriate level of authorization. Financial condition of the program, in the course of the history, we've had nearly 2,400 loans issued under the program for $161 million. Amazed at the level of loan losses. The loan losses that we've incurred has only been $200,000 on 15 loans. Now, again, that doesn't mean that we've had bankruptcies or loans that have been liquidated, but what this does mean is that once a loan goes through a liquidation and a sale, that the lender and the RFA have traditionally been able to recover the outstanding balance. We've written off interest on many occasions, but this just shows the principal write-off. So that's really an amazing statistic. And the delinquency rate right now is about 1.5%. The outstanding loan balance at the present time, or this was as of December 31, has about $55.7 million. Again, that's the 45% that we carry at that $55.7 million and about 623 borrowers. The other indication of the financial condition, the 2009 bond authorization, we've just started to draw on that bond authorization within the last month, and Peter could talk a little bit more about that. Forecast is given, you know, $9-10 million in activity every year, fiscal year, that we've got sufficient funds to get through into the August or summer or fall of next year, and that's a projection that we've got. So that's just a quick highlight overview, and either between Peter and myself, happy to answer any questions.
So again, just to confirm, we don't have to do anything with bond authorization this year. Your balances are good probably through the end of next year.
Correct.
So we'll revisit that next budget session.
Yep.
And if we have to do that, that'll be the time to do it.
Yes.
And give us a brief explanation. Why are we able to do this for farms and not for other businesses in the state? Yeah. Loan money, put it in bond, then give you the cash and repay. Why do we do it for farms? Why don't we do it for other small businesses in the state?
Very good question, Mr. Chairman. And I'd have to go back. I'm looking at some financial statements, but there is a constitutional authority. And the reason that the 86th legislature found authority to do this is that the Minnesota Constitution is under Article 11, Section 5, Clause H. And the language reads, under that constitution, to develop the state's agriculture resources by extending credit on real estate security. And we've had opinions from bond counsel and the attorney general's office looking at that constitutional statement. And it says again, to develop the state's agriculture resources by extending credit on agriculture security. So their definition is production agriculture.
So it's in our constitution.
Correct.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks again, Mr. Chair. Just a curious, Mr. Borboom, on the loan loss part of your presentation, on a real estate loan, for example, do you and the bank both take a first position, or how is that worked out, and how does the state protect itself?
Mr. Borboom.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, the lender, the ag lender, and the RFA share pro rata in the first mortgage. There's no senior lien or junior lien. Essentially, we have a contract. The RFA, I should say, has a contract with the lender, and under the terms of that contract, the lender files the mortgage, but we have a pro rata share. So when there is a sale or liquidation, then we split the proceeds 45-55. Same thing with a payment. If there's a payment that comes in, like $1,000 a month, for example, $450 comes to us and $550 stays at the bank.
Any other questions to this topic? Representative Magnus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Borboom and Mr. Shepard, has the RFA program ever given some thought to going in a more of a participation or a guarantee program instead of just a participation loan?
Mr. Borboom.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Magnus, that conversation has occurred. It's a conversation that I've resisted, and it's a direction that I resist. And so to answer your question, it is yes, but it is a higher credit risk, and it's a risk that I am not comfortable with or not what I would not recommend.
Okay. Just on that line, is there any other programs or other things that your board has talked about that, as you review what you do and what's available through your agency, is there something looming that you're looking at, whether it's new technologies or energy or other things that now are maybe not traditional farm but are coming? And are there some holes that we could fill with this program that aren't being met or that we see coming? And introduce yourself. You haven't talked yet.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Peter Shepard, the Executive Director of the Rural Finance Authority, as well as a Division Director within the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. It is a pleasure to join you today. We do have a very good board. Last year, they did a round, or a year, 2 years ago, did a round of some thinking and listening sessions to think through what the future is. I think Deputy Commissioner Borman brought that up when you looked at what the Constitution says when they found us as part of supporting agriculture. For the most part, their thoughts have been in line within agriculture and what do we need to do to support agriculture. The Department of Deed has other resources that are out there to help others. Doesn't mean we can't partner with some things, and we do look for opportunities to do that. Currently, we have started a Minnesota Farmer Assistance Network, and at another time we'll come before the committee to talk about that as a way of helping farmers that are facing some financial issues at the moment with some help and advice and volunteer analysts that way. We continue to look for opportunities for programs. The current five programs that we have through the bond funds, as well as some programs we have through a revolving fund, tend to meet the needs of the broad base of agriculture. We have things for livestock, crop producers, beginning farmers, restructure loans, to have been able to cover us so far. We are, though, always looking for more things, better ways of doing things. We hold our meetings, you know, by telephone three-quarters of the time to save travel costs and some of those type of things.
Okay. Any further questions? All right, I think that's a good segue into our next topic. Members, you're probably aware, you've probably gotten invitations throughout the summer and fall that the Department of Agriculture was out doing listening sessions, which I think is very good. The Commissioner's Office had people like Mr. Borboom and others, if not the Commissioner himself, out, which I thought was good, but I thought this committee should be aware. We want to know what they heard and what you're hearing out there. Certainly, we as a committee want to be responsive. If there's anything out there, specifics that we can do, whether I know, you know, whether it's permitting issues or whether it's ag finance issues or whatever it is, it's nice to have the listening sessions, but members, I think it's always good to bring those listening sessions back here to the policymakers, and if there's anything that we can accomplish over the next couple months based on those listening sessions, again, we would hope that the department is responding through legislation and working with us on it, but perhaps brainstorming together here after seeing your report, there may be other things we could look forward to in the next couple months. So we just want to report how are things out there in ag world.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, I'm happy to talk a bit about the format of the listening sessions, what we heard. There should be a summary sheet of the listening sessions that might be in your packets, and certainly a comment or some of my comments will be consistent with what's in that report. The Commissioner did the listening sessions in Fergus Falls, Roseau, and Grand Rapids. I did a series of sessions in southern Minnesota from Albert Lea to Redwood Falls and Pipestone, Minnesota. We partnered with the Area Chamber of Commerce, so this worked out to be a very good partnership where our communication staff contacted the executive director of the various chambers within those communities, asked if we could have them host or sponsor a listening session. It was well received by the chambers. The invitation would go out. We had anywhere from 25 to 45 people that participated in listening sessions. The format was a kind of a 10-minute overview of the state of agriculture, some comments by myself or commissioner, and then we went through a very informal facilitated discussion, and it was a great opportunity not only to hear some of the concerns or frustrations that the participants had, but also some ideas to hear what's going well and what change recommendations they had. The participants were largely farmers, but we also had a number of chamber members and bankers and business owners and just a wide range of participants at these listening sessions. Some of the concerns as to what we heard, obviously there was a lot of anxiety or frustration about the conditions in the pork sector and the dairy sector. Pork sector has been suffering some hard times for about 18 months, and the dairy sector within the last year, and what are we doing to address those issues, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. We heard about some of the other general conditions in agriculture, such as the regulatory environment, and some frustration about migrating the regulatory process or understanding the regulatory process, navigating the permits, permitting process, also just getting some timely decisions. We also heard concerns about land use development. I heard this both in Redwood Falls and in Pipestone, and the concern is about loss of productive farmland to either conservation initiatives or residential or commercial development initiatives, and then the impact that that would have on property taxes. So if we take farmland out of production and the shift to property taxes, that was a concern that was raised in a couple areas. We also heard concerns among farmers about the perception of non-farmers of how food is grown and processed. There's some frustration with farmers about getting the message out about modern production agriculture systems, and again about production, about animal husbandry practices, and the need to educate non-farmers about modern agriculture and farm practices. I think finally there was a lot of frustration about the influences in the market. Now, we've been through some adversity, and we talked about the adversity of the 80s earlier, and a lot of our parents remember managing some tough times, and they may have talked about commodity prices or livestock diseases or some of those things that influence agriculture. But today there's a lot of other influences like energy policy and fiscal policy and trade barriers and H1N1, all those things that seem to kind of stack on top of the existing environment. So, you know, there's frustration. How do we manage through all these other variables? I think we heard that with Jim Kielkow's presentation as well the other month. There was some of the things that we heard that were good or working well was the state support for renewable fuels. They were very positive about that. They were positive about the technical and marketing assistance that our agency has given toward organic growers and specialty crop growers and Minnesota Grown program. There was support for the loan programs offered by the Rural Finance Authority, and there was very good support again for the state's response to bovine tuberculosis. So a lot of positive news as well as some of the challenges. You know, we know that there's a lot to address with respect to the challenges, but some of the things that we do have in our toolkit to offer is that we do partner with farm organizations and commodity councils to promote Minnesota products. The state of Minnesota is the seventh largest exporter of agriculture products in the nation. Farm gate sales of crop and livestock products is $15.8 billion. $5.5 billion of that is sold at international markets. And I think we've got a good track record there, and Commissioner Hugesson has been a very strong voice in that regard. The livestock development team, which is headed by Kurt Zimmerman and Jim Osley and people like that, spend time one-on-one with farmers if they're looking at doing an upgrade or expansion of the livestock. They actually sit down with that farmer at the kitchen table and coach them through the permitting process. And we've had good working relationship with county feedlot officers. So part of it is just creating a mechanism or an awareness so producers can get through the matrix, get through the permitting process. And with respect to food, you know, there's some concern too about, again, animal husbandry practices and how production agriculture systems work. I think one of the things that we can do and we should do is, again, reach out and partner with other organizations like the Chamber of Commerce or civic organizations within those areas. Work with you. You're the elected officials. You know the people in your area. And we'd certainly be happy to be part of an effort to work with you and talk about the story of agriculture. We've got, if you look at our website and our communication staff, we've got tremendous resources and capacity within our agency. And the other thing, I would take a fact sheet about, like in Pipestone County, for example. If you look at Pipestone County, there's maybe only 630 farms in that county, but two-thirds of the economic activity in that county is dependent on livestock, and hogs are the big economic driver in Pipestone County. And then you look at the jobs, you could start telling a story about how many jobs are tied to Pipestone systems, for example. And it's a great story to tell. And there's some very good people that do, again, some best management practices in handling that livestock issue. So I think those are the things that we need to look at is, again, telling the story of agriculture, production ag, and helping people manage through the regulatory process.
Representative Welty.
Thank you, Chair Junkie, and to Deputy Commissioner Borboom. Did you ask at any of these listening sessions if farmers were aware of the programs through the Department of Agriculture?
Mr. Borgum.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Welty, I don't recall if I asked that question specifically, but in some cases I do know that there was or is a lack of awareness, and that is, again, something that we need to address.
Representative Welty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Deputy Commissioner Borgum. I would hope that you'd take this message back, and I sent a letter to Commissioner Hugesson and updating him on what I was hearing from the farmers that I talked to when I was out door knocking, and then not only that, we had a forum put on by Minnesota Farmers Union. And at that forum at the Minnesota Farmers Union put on, I specifically asked farmers, I said, I was talking about these different programs, and I said, how many of you are aware of the Livestock Investment Grant Program? No hands went up. And then I asked them about some of the other programs, the RFA programs. Maybe two in the room knew about them. I mean, it's not only an issue within the Department of Agriculture. I'll let you know that. I'm a part of this small business caucus, and they did a survey among the business owners, and there are a lot of small business owners that don't know about the programs that we have through DEED. But it was quite telling, though, that a lot of the farmers, especially at this time, with the economic challenges that they're facing, could benefit from the resources that we have, but many of them don't know about it. And so that's why in the letter to the commissioner, I specifically asked to do direct mailings or direct contacts with farmers to get the information out there, because they just don't know. And when I was out door knocking, I would, at a lot of farmers' homes, I talked to the individuals there, and I just recommended, I said, get a hold of the Department of Agriculture. You know, if you have any questions, need any technical assistance. And many of them thanked me, but they just weren't aware. And it's unfortunate, because we have a lot of programs and we have a lot of assistance and technical assistance and knowledge at the Department of Agriculture to share with farmers and producers and help them through these times, but they're just not aware of it.
Outreach, Mr. Borgum. How do we continue to improve on that?
A couple things, Mr. Chairman. Representative Welty, I would say that with respect to the Rural Finance Authority, access to that is through the ag lenders. Not all the farmers are going to be aware of that, nor they may not even need the program, but if they do need it, I think the task that we have is getting ag lenders aware. And Peter's done a great job working with independent bankers and community bankers. He can talk about some outreach efforts with respect to that. And I think I'd like to ask him to comment on the Livestock Investment Grant. But before I just hand it back to Peter, our website is a tremendous resource. And the other thing is linking our website maybe to other sites such as chambers or other organizations that might have an interest or are serving, you know, farm clientele. So happy to continue the conversation.
Is your website linked with other state agencies? I think that would be a first easy thing to do. Hugesson talked to McElroy and say put our link on the DEED website. Again, as you're looking at economic development tools and other things, does that happen within state agencies?
There, Mr. Chairman, there is some of that I'm aware of, but I'd have to go back and check our
site. And frankly, vice versa. DEED has a lot of drawing up business plans and things that farmers might have to do day-to-day or when they're entering a new venture. Are we putting the DEED information on the ag? I mean, I'm just thinking out loud with the committee right now, but I think there are some simple things we could do to help facilitate. More information is always better. Representative Welty.
Just one point, and because you referenced the internet. Out in greater Minnesota, there are several people that don't have high-speed internet access, and they're on dial-up, and they're frustrated. They don't want to wait for the web pages to download. That takes 2 or 3 minutes. So just to be aware, and that's one of the reasons why I said direct mailings or something of that nature, because a lot of people won't or don't have the time or don't go to the internet.
Representative Shemansky.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Borgum, a couple of questions. The one on the first page of this handout from the listening sessions, it talked about concern about land use developments and conservation easements and so forth. Are we answering the farmers' questions on that? In essence, because I know with the Lasard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council and the LCCMR on which I sit, you know, there's always pressure to buy more land for conservation purposes. And, you know, what were you hearing from the farmers out there?
Mr. Ballroom.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Szymanski, we heard exactly the concern that you've raised. The response was, from my perspective, is that there are House members and Senate members that are part of the Lasard Council. Those members are from rural areas. They understand the issue. I think part of it is that we're looking at some, maybe some grazing options, especially the bee producers. We're concerned about taking away or removing land for grazing purposes, and if we could look at a way to implement grazing on public lands or accelerate that. We've got staff within Peter's division that looks at writing grazing plans. There's also some interest in saying, is there some way to capture some tax or some revenue in lieu of property taxes? I guess that would be a legislative question as well. So we're, you know, what we're hearing is the concern. The address of that concern is just, again, to reassure that we understand the issue and that rural legislators also understand the issue.
Representative Szymanski.
And I think it's part of, you know, conveying that message to the other legislators around this body as well. Another question would be on environmentalist impact on agriculture. Various committees here, they're talking about restricting or eliminating some certain pesticides or slowing down the flow of surface drainage water in the agricultural areas. And did you hear concerns of that in your hearings as well?
Mr. Borbo.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Szymanski, we did hear some concern about, again, the people that want to restrict or limit the use of pesticides and herbicides. And my answer to that is that if you look at our agency, we have very robust information on best management practices and advice on following label restrictions on setback requirements and application rates. We license, you know, commercial applicators and farmers as well. So I think there's, you know, certainly to say no to any use of herbicides and pesticides could be misguided, but we want to look at the proper use of those products, again, because of the benefits that they provide.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to the department, I want to thank you for going out and listening to farmers as well, because what I hear is exactly what you said. It's help us tell our story. We have a good story to tell. We don't always do the best job telling it, but it's up to each and every one of us. And if you can take a lead role in that, or continue to take a lead role in that, it's greatly appreciated. Then help us through the regulatory piece. You know, as a livestock producer myself, you know, it's ridiculous to think anything other than we care. We care about our animals, we care about our facilities, we care about the environment, we care about our communities. And all too often, the opposition paint us with the ugly brush, and they put us all in the same category. And then when you're dealing with misinformation or emotion, a lot of times legislation takes place that places on undue hardship on farmers and other people as well. And we need your help, we need your guidance and your leadership to make sure that the accurate information is conveyed so stuff like that doesn't happen. And then the encouragement to all of us to get out there and tell our stories, because we do have a good story to tell. Thank you.
And just following up on what Representative Hamilton said, I'm going to drill down before we leave here on your first bullet point. And I like what you brought us here, but again, I want more specifics from you in the future. Concern about the business climate for agriculture Minnesota, particularly regulatory requirements and continued difficult navigating permitting process at the state and local level and getting timely, reasonable decisions. So that sentence tells me there's all sorts of questions or problems or concerns about permitting. They're not getting their permit time is slower than it should be. I mean, I came through the feedlot rule making process. It took a couple years, about 10 years ago, and we set some time parameters for decisions to be made on permits, etc. But this paragraph is nice, but I want to know what. And I'll give you one example, members. I have a bill, and you're all welcome to sign on to it. The poultry folks came to me, but it could apply to any animal agriculture. Federal government, the Obama administration, does not require MPDES permits unless you're discharging to water. Back when we put in our feedlot rules, there was a sense at that time that they were going to require it federally. So rather than wait and respond, we actually made it a requirement for over 1,000 animal units, which my poultry folks and others that have poultry fall into, even though they don't discharge. So we made it a part of it. Now, as time has progressed, we see there's no requirement federally, so I've got a bill to take that requirement off here now, and that will help our poultry people or any other large livestock people that hit that 1,000 animal unit. If they discharge into water, they still have to get the permit. That's what a discharge permit is for. So that was a specific example brought to me. With this paragraph, I'm hoping there's some specific examples you heard out there so that we as a committee can introduce legislation or entertain legislation to address that. It's one thing for someone to sit and complain, but I always want to get the specifics so we can do something. Can you help us out with that?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, that's a very good question, and I took in each of the listening sessions we had a communications person with us taking notes, and I took some of my own notes. So let me go back and take a look at the notes and see if I can capture some of those specific incidents. I can appreciate what you're looking
for. And we'd appreciate it. We have the chair of the Environment Committee sitting here. We have a lot of senior members, Hamilton, Magnus, others, that we've seen a lot of this come and go, and we want to make it work. We're certainly sensitive, as Representative Hamilton and others have said. Farmers are the best environmentalists in the state, and we want to make sure we continue that notion. But if there's things we can, if there's duplicative paperwork between PCA and DNR and agriculture and Bowser and the federal government and all these different agencies that get involved, you know, can we simplify that? Is there something we can do this session to make those small businesses function more efficiently out there in our area? So if you would help us with more specifics on anything in here, that's one example, but get your notes up, and over the next few weeks, if you could get us anything that's specific that we can do, that's what we're interested in. Anything else? Well, Representative Hamilton.
To that point, Mr. Chairman, you're absolutely right. And the important thing, even without having that NPDES permit, all the livestock producers and anybody else, they still have to be in compliance with the state regulations. They'll still have a state permit. And it's not like we're lessening any of the restrictions whatsoever. It's just one less burden and one less expense. You're absolutely right.
Any other discussion or questions? Otherwise, this has been a good meeting. I learned a lot, and hopefully it'll help lead us into the next few weeks. Members, next week, Tuesday, we'll be doing Veterans Affairs budgeting overviews, and on Wednesday, the Department of Agriculture will be back again, and AURI and Board of Animal Health and all the other divisions we do to understand the governor's request on budgets and start our work down to that end. So, seeing no other business, the committee is adjourned.